we have a lot to talk about today. We are finishing up the topic of censorship by the Catholic Church, and then moving into the topic of this bizarre publishing war in the 16th century. And really, it's such a fascinating story. And our learning this morning is dedicated in memory of Esther Chava Bas Chaim Halevi and Rachel. The neshama should have an aliyah. The yard site is today. So, let's see. Sorry. I'm in a new room, as I commented to some people here who were here in the beginning, and I'm using sort of a standing desk type of a thing and trying to juggle sheets and the computer and you, and it's a lot of fun. So we started out our topic about censorship by talking about the early days of censorship, the fact that it really wasn't about the Jews in the early days. It was an attack really on heresy, that the church came into a religious world in which Judaism had an element of censorship to it as well. It's not the same as what the church would do, but certainly there's an idea of keeping people away from ideas that can mislead. And the Greeks were very much in favor of censorship as well. Not necessarily all Greeks, but Plato was very strong in this regard. We talked about how during the Dark Ages, censorship sort of dies down. There isn't a threat to the church from different ideas, because people really aren't as intellectually focused. Censorship is revived with Peter the Venerable in the 12th century. He wants to study heresy in the words of the heretics. Someone at the very end had asked me last time, I think when I stayed on for a few minutes afterwards, if Peter the Venerable was the same as Peter Abelard. And I said at the time, well, I can Google it, and I Googled it, and I read an article way too quickly, and therefore said, oh yeah, they're the same, but they're not the same. No, they read a little more slowly, and you realize they were connected, they interacted, but no, they're two different people. So let's correct that misconception. Someone else noted in an email to me afterwards that the 12th century also sees sort of a mini renaissance and a return of some element of intellectual study, which could have influenced that revival of censorship during that period. But the really, as you move into the 13th century, you see a growth in philosophy, and you also see a restart of censorship because there are new options for censoring. The church tries to bring the work of censorship in-house, trying to rely less on governments in order to carry it out. They establish their own Inquisition courts. They establish the orders of the Dominicans and the Franciscans to carry it out. Someone had asked me afterwards in an email whether we know anything about the involvement of nuns in this. There were female orders as well that were attached to the Dominicans and the Franciscans. I'm blanking now on the name, but there's actually a name for the female Franciscans, but I have not seen anything about their involvement in carrying out inquisitorial activities. That I did not find. In the 13th century, we talked about the debate with Rabbi Achiel of Paris leading to the 1240 burning of the Talmud in France. And we also talked about the disputation in 1263 with Nachmanides before King James of Aragon. And then we moved from that through 14th century, 15th century, into the late 15th century, and the arrival of the printing press, which really makes the church fear that the end is nigh for them, because the printing press allows you to disseminate information in ways that they can't really combat. And there's a revival of censorship. We talked about Joseph Johann Pfefferkorn, who was a former Jew, just like Nicholas Donin, just like Pablo Christiani, who publishes a book, Das Judenspiegel, intended to be the first in a series of attacks on the Talmud, and he tries to get the Talmud to be censored. We talked about very quickly at the end last time how that goes back and forth. Johann Reuchlin is in combat against him. But that brought us to the year 1559, and that's where we go forward. And I put it on the source sheet as source number one. We mentioned it at the end last time. The Index Librorum Prohibitorum, publicized in 1559 by Pope Paul IV. And this is their list of off-limits books. Interestingly, what I've read is that they generally resisted listing Hebrew books in the index because they felt it would honor them. But ultimately they expand this. This is not like one-time list and then it's done. It grows and it comes to include many Hebrew texts. They also employ a new method of censorship, and this is something we referred to very briefly last week. It's something called expurgation. Expurgation means we're not necessarily going to censor a book by saying you're not allowed to have it, you're not allowed to own it, you're not allowed to print it, as much as what we're going to do instead is say specific passages, specific words have to be omitted, have to be gotten rid of one way or another. Passages that teach lessons about God that the church disagrees with, such as anthropomorphism. Judaism is very into presenting God in not a physical form, but using physical terms in order to make God more comprehensible to the human mind. So we talk about the hand of God, we describe God as being angry, and the church felt that all of this is off limits, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. I hadn't really thought about this before, but it's kind of ironic when on the one hand you're saying all anthropomorphism is bad, and on the other hand you're saying that God is actually a human being too, right? The whole Trinity concept. I'm not sure exactly how that works. Maybe that's why they needed to be worried about anthropomorphism, because they were already so far down the line towards it. I don't know. That's just musing. But they didn't like any ideas that would teach bad morals. Bad morals meaning, again, anything the church doesn't approve of. What they frequently did was they substituted words. So, for example, the word Talmud, which is the term that refers to the verbal tradition of Torah, meaning, the brief primer for those who I haven't discussed this with before, for those who were in a class where we talked about this, the Torah is given as a written text, but it's very clearly accompanied by a verbal explanation. And you know that because when you open up a text of the Pentateuch, of the Chumash, and you try to read it, you instantly find things which are incomprehensible unless there is some kind of traditional explanation for it. Favorite example, the mitzvah of tefillin, right? Having the leather boxes, black leather boxes with the straps, one goes on the arm, one goes on the head. Right? The Torah does not give you a description of what they look like, what they're made of, what their color is, how long they are, how they're made. The only thing that the Torah says is, you shall wear tota, you shall tie totafot. That's it. Between your eyes and on your arm. That's all the description you get. Clearly there's a verbal explanation, a cultural understanding of what these totafot are. That tradition of what it is, that verbal explanation, is passed down generation, 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 until it is recorded as a brief outline of law as the Mishnah, beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. There are lots of reasons that brought the sages to decide to write it down, but that's not our discussion right now. That's the Mishnah. They keep on writing an explanation and expansion of it. That becomes known as Gemara. And the two together are Mishnah plus Gemara equals Talmud. It's concluded, at least canonized at first, in the 6th century Common Era. There is way more to talk about with this. I'm really oversimplifying because it's not the point of our discussion right now. But the point is that Mishnah plus Gemara, this verbal tradition that is then written down, is what we call Talmud. And the church, when they decide that the Talmud is heretical, say, not only do we not want people learning the Talmud, we don't want the word Talmud to appear. So if the word Talmud appears, we eradicate it. So what did we do? What did Jews do if you can't use the word Talmud? So we used other words. So we said Mishnah and Gemara. Or we said Shas. Anyone know what the word Shas stands for? It's an acronym. What does it stand for? Don't tell me the Sephardi political party in Israel.
Shisha Sidarim.
Right, she's good. Rukama said it. Shisha Sidarim. six orders, because the Mishnah is actually arranged in six areas, six different orders as we call it in English. In Hebrew, Shisha Sidarim, and it's a term that comes to be used first for Mishnah and then for Talmud as a whole. So when you speak about somebody learning their way through the entire Talmud, you'll say they're learning Shas, or they learned Shas, or they completed Shas. That's how the term is used. So one of the interesting side results of this is that if you were to ask someone in a standard yeshiva today, an academy where traditional learning takes place, who's sitting and learning Gemara, you'd say to him, are you learning Talmud? Very often they would look at you funny. Like, I'm learning Gemara. They wouldn't say, I'm learning Talmud. The word Talmud became an academic term because it couldn't be used for so long. People instead used Mishnah, Gemara, Shas instead of Talmud. Kind of a funny thing, the way that works. Another change that they made is very, very odd and has some very confusing results. You know, of course, that the Catholic Church was based in
Rome.
Rome, right. It was based in Rome. Rome, which...
Constantinople.
The Catholic Church. At this stage, the Catholic Church is in Rome. So the Talmud will often refer to Rome either as Romi or as Edom. Right? Longer discussion as to why Edom, but that's the way it's usually referred to. Well, the censors didn't like that. They didn't want us saying anything that related to them, and certainly anything that might cast them in a bad light. So their expurgation included substituting the word Persian every time that the Talmud uses the word Edomi. Instead of saying Edomite, it would now say Persian. So that leads to some very odd things. And I'll give you an example on your source sheet. If you take a look at source number 2, there's a story in the Talmud, and I presented it as it appears in the original text. Someone noted in the chat, Edomite derived from Esav. That's correct. There's a lot more to say, though, about how Edom comes to refer to Rome, because there's no lineage line from Esav to Rome that we can trace. But going back to this passage in source number 2, the story goes, an Edomite pushed Rabbi Eliezer, one of the sages, and a snake that had been there bit him, meaning bit the Edomite, causing Rabbi Eliezer to quote a verse from Isaiah, Vasim Adam Tachtecha, I will place Adam, literally a man, beneath you. In other words, the Edomite pushed him, the Edomite got bitten. Edom, Adam. It's a play on words. It's a play on words. Sorry?
Computer, you download it, you're coming in and out, and then you're flying, and then you're going in and out.
Probably because I'm moving. He says, I will place Adam beneath you as a play on Edom. The Edomi pushed me, and the Edomi got bitten by the snake. It's a play on words from the biblical verse. But once they expurgate the line, it's completely meaningless. Because the way that they censored it was, a Persian pushed Rabbi Eliezer, a snake that had been there bit the Persian, causing Rabbi Eliezer to cite the verse, I will place Adam beneath you. You completely lose the play on words from Edomite to Persian. If you got that good, if you didn't get it, just write it off. Don't worry about it. But it's an example of how puns in the Talmud get completely warped due to censorship. They also annotate.
What is Persian? Parsi? Or what do they
call it? Yeah, Parsi.
What's the word they use?
Parsi. Yeah. They also annotate things. So, for example, one of the terms that's used rabbinically for someone who is heretical is a min. Min. Mem yud nun. It's a term that's used for somebody who attacks the Torah. However, the Christians were sensitive and felt that that may be a reference to them. So when it said min in the text, in the margin they would write, these are Jews who have forsaken God. In other words, that's not us. That's not the church. It's a reference to Jews who are heretical. This list that starts in the year 1559 and grows, continues until 1966. 1966, Pope Paul VI, after the Second Vatican Council, decides to get rid of the index. But not because the church had become liberal. And now they you know, felt like, well, let's stop burning people's books and censoring and expurgating people's books. That wasn't it. The problem was they couldn't keep up with all the literature, and they couldn't enforce it. But it remains a sin on the books for Catholics to read texts that are injurious to faith or morals. So this is still a concern for them. There's a note in the chat. Have the censorship changes been restored in later editions of the Talmud? And the answer is that modern editions of the Talmud do tend to try to restore the original text. The Steinsaltz edition is famous for doing so. It causes some bit of controversy because making sure that you have the accurate manuscript it can be a little bit challenging. It's also challenging because Jews for centuries and centuries have been using a text that looks one way and it's quoted in all their sources one way, and now to start introducing a new version of it can create a lot of confusion. But yes, modern editions often do restore that which had been censored. Okay, my review questions on the sheet should help people, I hope, to review what we've been doing, but I'm not going to go through them right now. I did a review just now in the beginning when we started, and we're short on time with it. The mechanics of censorship. So the church needed to develop new methods over time, because the old methods, confiscating books and destroying them, just weren't working. It didn't work, first of all, because Jews would hide their books. They'd hide them at the roots of trees. They'd hide them in wells. We would find places in order to be able to keep the books. But also, there was a black market. The Christians would save the books and then resell them to the Jews. So, therefore, this wasn't working. Confiscation wasn't working. The other problem they had was that as Europe became more liberal, they tended to frown on these very harsh methods of burning and destroying books. So expurgation, this method we've been talking about, was something that Jews could tolerate more. Yeah, they take a line here, they take a line there, we know what it should say anyway, and therefore Jews didn't feel driven to extremes to avoid and defeat it. So this already has, you have elements of expurgation back in the 13th century, but it begins in earnest in Italy in the 16th century, and then in the 17th century it spreads beyond Italy. And here's what would happen. All the Jews in a particular region were told to bring their books by a particular date to the censors. The censors would give you a receipt for your book. And then, different censors had different methods. Erasing things was really tedious. So what they would usually do was take ink and blot whatever it was that had been in the book. Sometimes they would use a fine brush, you know, and then they would just cover the words, make it illegible. Sometimes they used a big brush, and they cover the bulk of a page. You can see this. Like, these texts are around to actually see the way this was done. Sometimes you get a careless censor, and the careless censor would just draw a few lines through a whole paragraph to censor the paragraph, but like you could read between those lines. Rarely they would actually cut out a page or part of a page, or they would take printed paper and paste it over that spot in order that people shouldn't be able to read it. And the censors would sign a page at the end of the book certifying this is now a clean text. The censors were often Jews, because a lot of the censors couldn't read Hebrew. So they would bring in Jews, and the Jews would help them to, first of all, compile a list of passages that had to be expurgated, and then to carry out the censorship. And eventually it fell to the College of Neophytes. The College of Neophytes were Jews who had converted out of Judaism. They created a text. The text is what you see some of here in source number 3, Sefer HaZikuk. Sefer HaZikuk lists specific passages and words as well as certain rules for what should be censored. It was written between 1594 and 1596 by a Jew who had converted to Christianity, Domenico Eroso Limitano. Oh, Eroso Limitano. That's really interesting. I just got that. What is Eroso Limitano? I just realized that. That's funny. It's Jerusalemite. Eroso Limitano is Yerushalmi, Jerusalemite. That's very interesting. Okay. In any case, he was the one who first created this, and copies of this exist, including one written in his handwriting. So I gave you on the sheet in source number 3 some of the rules they had. So for example, if you look at rule number 8 within source 3, I was wondering, Margot, about what you wrote there. Is this the origin of the expression reading between the lines? I don't know. I was wondering the same thing as I said that before. If anyone wants to Google it and let us know, that's fine. Any place in the Bible where debate and difference exists between the Jewish faith and ours, if there is an explicit challenge to our understanding, the Christian one, or if it brings a proof for the Jewish view, even if the names of Christian scholars are not mentioned openly, the entire matter must be erased. But if the matter is explained according to their opinion, but without a challenge to our faith, then it is no matter. Then we're okay. We don't want them explicitly challenging our faith, and if they do, then it has to be erased. Any instance of an insult against a law of the laws of our faith, or our teachings, or any custom or practice, or an insult toward a king, officer, or one of the holy priests of our nation, should be entirely erased. Any place that mentions something which is a great heresy, transmigration of souls, Gilgal, reincarnation. We had a class on that last year, you'll recall. Was it last year or earlier this year? COVID has so ruined my sense of time. We did it, though. I remember. I was there. But anyway, any place that mentions a great heresy like transmigration of souls, the idea that all souls were created during the 6 days of creation, or that God cries, or that the souls of the wicked are turned into demons, or that the evil spirits which possess people are the souls of the wicked deceased and the like, the entire thing should be erased. Some of these aren't Jewish ideas anyway. They're just ideas that the church doesn't like, and that the church wants to have eliminated. And so on. Number 14, any place that mentions festivals, holidays, or celebrations of ours in an insulting way, such as Lifnei Edehem and the like, I'll explain that in a moment, or if it says it is prohibited for an Israelite to transact business with them on those days, should be erased. Meaning, there actually is a law stated in the Talmud that Jews are not to do business with non-Jews around the time that they're celebrating their religious holidays, because they'll be very happy about their transaction, and they're going to go thank their God for their success in business, and you're not supposed to fuel their joy on their religious holiday. That's this line. There's more to be said about the phrase Lifnei Edehem, but I think I'm going to continue here because there's so much again to talk about. So again, originally, as in the case with King James, Jews were opposed to expurgation in Italy, but they came to want it because it was the least of the evils offered, and actually the Jews came to fund it. You want to know who was paying the censors? We were the ones who paid the censors in order to avoid having our books simply taken away and burnt. So the church has the Jews pay to censor their own books. There was also something called self-censorship, which I'm going to come back to shortly. But a little bit of comic relief here, and this will be more clear to those who are Hebrew speakers. Nonetheless, some of the absurdity of what went on, specifically in 19th century Russia, the Eastern Church and their censorship. I'll give you two examples. Number one, there's something called kitniot, right? Kitniot is a term that's usually translated as legumes, although it's not really, but that's the way people translate it. Ashkenazim have the practice of avoiding certain foods on Passover, even though those foods are not chametz, but because they either are processed with grain normally, or because they're processed in the same way that grain is processed, or baked in the way that grain is baked, you could confuse them for chametz. So Ashkenazim, going back 700 years or so, have refrained from them on Passover. That's in a nutshell. That law is not relevant for us right now. What is relevant for us is that when you have discussions in rabbinic texts about this, they talk about whether different species of plants are species of kitniot. Tell me, how do you say species in Hebrew?
Min.
Min, correct. You use the word min. which I told you before is also a term for somebody who is heretical. So the censors decided that when it says min, they're going to change min to say instead akum, which means worshiper of the stars and constellations. So when you get these lines in rabbinic books about akum kitniot, worshiper of the stars, legumes, instead of saying species of legumes, because they're just seeing, you know what it's like? If you ever do a search and replace in a document, and accidentally you replace the wrong thing, because you didn't realize something else was going to get caught up. That's what they're doing with their censorship. It's kind of comical. And one other one that's also very very funny. In 1830, the Russians were engaged in a war with the Turks, with the Ottoman Empire. So every time they saw the word goy, which they took to be a derogatory term, every time they saw the word goy in a Jewish text, they substituted Yishmael, Ishmaelite, because it should refer to the Ottomans, not to them. And the result is a fascinating prayer. There's a daily prayer called Tachanun. It's not said on Shabbat and holidays, but it's said during the week. And in this prayer, traditionally we say, Shomer Goy Kadosh, Moshe Rit Am Kadosh, right? Guardian of the holy nation, meaning us. The word Goy refers to the Jews. Guardian of the holy nation, guard the remnant of the holy nation. However, they didn't like the word Goy. They did a search and replace. So they changed it to Turk. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, you get the censored edition of this Tachanun prayer. Guardian of the Holy Turk, guard the remnant of the Holy Turk, and let not the Holy Turk be destroyed. That's what you end up with because of this somewhat mindless censorship. Okay. The roles that the Jews played in this censorship. So there's a legend, and I stress legend, that we ended up being the ones to cause the burning of the Talmud in the year 1240. I brought you material on it in source number 5, but I'm going to explain it outside of the text in the interests of time. Maimonides was very prolific in his works of law and his works of philosophy, going back to the 12th century. But not everybody agreed with what he did. In his works of law, he attempted to condense, summarize, and codify the laws of the Talmud, and he said, from now on, people don't have to slog through the Talmud, they can read my writing on this, and that'll be enough. And others were very unhappy that he did that. He didn't even include sources for his conclusions, he just said, here are the conclusions. In his works of philosophy, he was extremely rationalist, and he disagreed with others on major philosophical issues. And again, some didn't like it. And the legend goes that Jews who opposed the writing of Maimonides, after he already passed away in the 13th century, went to the church to say to them, these Maimonidean writings are heretical, with the goal of censorship of Jewish writings, and that this led to the church examining the Talmud and deciding to burn it in the year 1240. That's a classic allegation. It goes back to some early texts, which you can see here, quoted in source number 5. It's extremely unlikely that was actually what happened, but it does teach a good moral lesson about how we fight with each other and not going too far. But what was the role that Jews played? So obviously, converted Jews were the biggest help to them. We've talked about that before. And we've said that Jews came to want expurgation as a better option. But Jews also employed self-censorship. We became self-censors in order to avoid the church doing worse. So sometimes authors themselves would censor their own works, so that when the Talmud speaks about differences between Jews and non-Jews for certain laws, you sometimes get a disclaimer in the margin saying, you should know this applies to ancient idolaters, it doesn't apply to the Christians among whom we live, who have laws and who have morality, and this is absolutely not a reference to them. Similarly, if you take a look at source number 6 on your sheet, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, was the rabbi in Novardok in Lithuania at the end of the 19th century, very beginning of the 20th century. And here he's talking about the status of a Torah scroll written by somebody who does not actually believe in God and Torah and so forth. And he says such a Torah scroll is disqualified by the Torah. But the writer's intent, sorry, you know what? Yeah, I'm not going to go through the text itself. I should have clarified more by inserting things, and I didn't. So I'm just going to leave that. My point is simply to say that he talks about a Torah scroll written by an Egyptian. Jews living in Novardok in Lithuania at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, did not know any Egyptians. There were no Egyptians hanging out there. Why would he have used the term Egyptian? What he really means is a Christian. But he can't say Christian, because then he'll get censored. So therefore, he writes the word Egyptian. I think he chooses Egyptian specifically, because how do you say Christian in Hebrew? Nosri. How do you say Egyptian in Hebrew?
Notsri
and Mitzri. And the Nun Vav of Notsri looks very similar to the Mem of Mitzri. So I suspect that that's why he chooses that, in order to be a hint to the reader of what exactly he's talking about here. He uses it in a few cases. So Jewish communities, besides the authors, would agree to this censorship, so much so. The Sansino Talmud is published at the end of the 15th century by a Jew, Gershom of Sansino. And he omitted passages that the Christians were censoring. And he even went beyond what they did. He omitted all references to Rome, all references to Nostra, to the Nazarene. He left little spaces to note that there was an omission, but he did it himself. And in June of 1554, the Jewish communities in various places declared a requirement that if you want to publish a book, your book has to be approved by a three-member Beit Din, a three-member rabbinical court. You also needed the approval of the leader of the community. And if you were in a small town, then you needed instead the leader of the nearest large community. So every book had to have the stamp of approval of a rabbinical court and the leader of a community before you could publish it, in order to make sure that only responsible works would be published. We were so afraid of the church's censorship. And that led to an interesting development. Something called the Haskama. Haskama literally is an agreement. And what... Sorry? It's an agreement. So in 1560, there's a Polish edition of the Talmud that is published with a rabbinic letter saying we agree to the publication of this. And it's fascinating because the Haskama has evolved since then in entirely different directions. It starts out, the Haskama begins as a means of saying, I approved this, it's okay to publish. It changed from that to become a statement about copyright, protecting the copyright of the publisher and saying no one should copy this and sell it for themselves. And then it became what a Haskama became, let's say, 100 years ago or so, which was a letter by a rabbi saying, I have read this work and I think that it's really, really good and therefore everybody should read it. And that evolved to become what the Haskama is today, which generally is, I know the writer of the book, I haven't really read this, I may have looked at a couple of pages, but generally it's good. So the Haskama has an evolution. It starts out as a means of getting the book published and saying it's already been reviewed for censoring issues. It becomes copyright protection. It becomes marketing tool, essentially, review of the book. And then it becomes just, yeah, I know him and he's a good guy. So really, it changes over time. What they ended up doing with this idea of rabbinic approval evolves over time, so that in Poland, middle of the 17th century, the rabbi sent out a letter ordering all of their printing presses and their communities to omit any reference to the Christian Savior in new editions of the Talmud, but to leave a space with an O, with a circle. And the rabbis would know how to teach it. If you take a look, I put that in source number 7. I put the Polish rabbinic decree there from 1631 on the sheet. There is a lasting impact on Judaism from all of this in a variety of ways, and not just the use of the word Talmud. First of all, in the year 553, early on in this whole thing, Justinian forbids Jews from using any text of the Bible in translation other than Greek or Latin. He forbids what was called Targum. Targum, what is Targum? Anyone can tell me?
Translation.
So Targum is the term that we use. Sorry?
Is it Aramaic?
So literally, Targum is a translation. However, the classic translations were, as Mark says, Aramaic. Going back to Talmudic times, the way people studied biblical text was with Aramaic translation and commentary. In the synagogue, in between each line of the Torah reading, you would have somebody read out an Aramaic explanation. Exactly. Onkelos comes from one such commentary. It was a very popular one. There were actually more than one. So the church forbids Jews from using the Targum. I've speculated that that may have contributed to the end of the use of Targum during the Torah reading in Ashkenazi communities. It persisted for a much longer time in Sephardic communities. There are still Yemenite communities that do it to this day. Because they pronounce the letter Gimel as a J, they call it Targum. But I was on a UJA trip 15, 16 years ago or so in Israel. I went to a Yemenite Moshav and they showed me their text of the Targum. It was fascinating. So it stops in Ashkenazi communities for the most part, although there are elements of it that remain for centuries afterwards. But that's one change. Another effect is on the Siddur, on our liturgy. So the most famous attack on Jewish liturgy came in 1240 in France. And that was the attack on Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre, of course, is recited on the night of Yom Kippur. It is a declaration that we don't intend to actually accept vows in the year ahead, or we are asking for forgiveness for the vows from the year past, depending on how you read Kol Nidre, or both. But the church argued that the purpose of Kol Nidre was to release Jews from all obligations to non-Jews. And that charge continued in Italy, Germany, and other places for centuries to come, such that early reform actually omitted Kol Nidre from their Machzor because of the church's allegations of what Kol Nidre was all about. That was one very interesting result. Another is the censorship of Aleinu. There is a line in Aleinu, which is right before people bow. The Aleinu prayer is, I think of it as sort of the national anthem of Judaism. It talks about what we want to see happen as an ultimate future, bringing all people to recognition of God and so on. And it's recited traditionally at the end of each prayer session, at the end of each tefillah. So there's a line in it in which people bow before God. And that bowing is contrasted with the way the nations of the world bow. So take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 8, where I gave you my translation of the sentence. For they bow to worthlessness and emptiness, and pray to a God who does not save, and we bow before God, King of Kings, and so on. Well, the church really didn't like that line. They took that as a slam on Christianity. This was at the end of the 14th century in Germany. It's incorrect, meaning this text is actually extremely, extremely old. At the latest, it's 3rd century Common Era, and by tradition, it goes way back to Joshua. Like, that's how old Jews considered this to be. No one was saying this line thinking that it was an attack on Christianity. However, there was a Jew who had converted to Christianity who pointed out the word in Hebrew in source number 8. The word for and emptiness is varik. which means and emptiness. However, if you're a fan of gematria, in which you associate every Hebrew letter with a numerical value, you will notice that the gematria of Varik is 316. That's what it is, 316. So what? 316 is also the gematria of Yeshu. Yep, Yeshu, Jesus. So they argue that that was actually a hint at their Savior. And the Jews argued and argued and said, what are you talking about? This has nothing to do with Christianity at all. Nonetheless, the Jews said, you know what? This ain't worth it. So either they just did for they bow and stopped there and said, and we bow to the God, dot, 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 or they omitted the entire line. And it's only in the 20th century that Sidurim, prayer books, came to readmit this line into the Sidur when they stopped being afraid of censorship. And yes, I understand that there will be some people who will be uncomfortable with this sentence because they feel like it's judgmental of the nations of the world. That's a great topic for another time. But fundamentally, this was inherent in the prayer, and it came to be removed from a central prayer of Judaism because the church viewed it as an attack on Christianity. So that was a major... Yeah, there were the changes like that in liturgy. Another change, rabbinical courts came to have authority over publication, as we mentioned before. And authors of texts started to use disclaimers in their texts, like I mentioned earlier, that we don't mean this about the Christians, we're talking about others, and so on. But perhaps the biggest and most dramatic impact is something that is actually noted on Tisha B'Av as part of the liturgy of the day. The one of the keynotes, one of the elegies, paragraphs of grief for the destruction which is mourned on Tisha B'Av, speaks about the burning of the Talmud. I mentioned it last week, Shalit Shrufa Ba'esh. And in that paragraph, there is a line which talks about all we have lost. The whole thing talks about all we have lost, but there's a line which I didn't bring on your sheet. Mi yafli nizirut. It asks, who will explain the vows of the Nazir? Who will evaluate vows? It's a bizarre line. What are you talking about? We don't have people taking vows of being a Nazir. What is this? The answer is, it's playing on biblical text. The law of the Nazir is introduced in the Torah with the word Yafli. The word Erech is associated with Neder, for those who know the Hebrew, but it's not the point. What this is really about is if you were to open a standard volume of the Talmud, and if we had time, I would share it on my screen so that you could see it. But a standard edition of the Talmud is published with Rashi's commentary. However, on certain volumes of the Talmud, we don't have Rashi's commentary anymore, including the volumes of Nazir and Nedarim. There we don't have Rashi's commentary. It's simply missing. Why is it missing? Did he never comment on it? Exceedingly unlikely. The reason we don't have it is because in the year 1240, they burned the Talmud in Paris. They burned the copies of his commentary, and so we're missing it. And so this line in that passage that said on Tisha B'Av says, who in the world is now going to clarify the volume of Nazir? Who is going to explain the volume of Nidarim? We don't understand it anymore. Because we're missing Rashi's classic commentary to the text. It destroyed that element of Jewish tradition and teaching. We don't have it anymore, and much more besides. So that's another impact of this. So I'm going to pause here. Someone asked me in the chat, did trying to publish a prohibited book lead to only censorship of the text or community punishment? My understanding is it depended on the gravity of what was done. If it was considered a minor offense, then you'd have a fine or something like that. But there were times when communities as a whole were published for what was considered an attack on the church. You could end up bringing in the Inquisition to actually investigate the community. Other questions on this before we spend our remaining time to discuss the beginning about the copyright battle of the 16th century? Yes, Claudette.
Rabbi, I can't do an ad. All this material is properly within Shkinza. right?
I can't hear you well. I'm sorry. Can you speak louder?
What is happening to Talmud? What is happening to the Talmud in, say, that in the Persian land? Is there any written work still in the Persian land that was not touched?
Yes.
And do we have that?
Yes. I don't believe we have any record of censorship going on in Muslim lands. We didn't have it great, but I have not seen any record of censorship going on in those lands.
But do we still have that too from them?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I know we have some. The Cairo Geniza has loads of manuscripts dating back to that era. There's actually a Toronto-based or Toronto-honored, I don't know what to call it exactly, website, the Friedberg Geniza Project, which is dedicated by the Friedberg family from Toronto, has manuscripts you can see online from the Cairo Geniza, and you can go back and look at remarkable stuff. Maimonides' own handwriting is available there. It's really something. The Friedberg Geniza Project. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions before we go further? There's a note in the chat to me asking when the Haftarah was introduced. The Haftarah is relatively early on in this, but not a product of censorship. It's a product of a different problem, censorship of ritual, not censorship of text. Okay. So let's shift gears.